This is CliffCentral.com.
There are far more important things to discuss with a far more important person who has just survived the mess that is the road. Because for whatever reason, Justice Malala, when it rains, people's brains turn to mush. Don't know how to drive.
It's terrible. Behaving like politicians there.
Oh, that's the line of the day. Good morning, Mr. Malala.
Good morning, guys. Sorry about that. The M1 is nuts this morning, but it's Joburg. Huh?
People get their windscreens get wet, and suddenly they always have right of way.
That is true. I saw it today. But also, everyone is on their phones. It's quite something, huh? I mean, I don't understand, but people are driving with their phones in their hands. And I sit there and I think there is no way that you don't have what, you know, happened this morning with the taxi overturning and so forth. People are just not concentrating on what they're doing. But also, you know, politically, we used to complain about the traffic and the traffic lights in Joburg when the ANC was running the city.
There we go.
And the traffic lights are still not working, and we run by the DA. Isn't it great?
Don't do that. Just dance.
Of course, reminder.
When the EFF comes in,
they still won't be working. So no matter who's in charge, the solutions that you're looking for will still not be found.
How can it be? If you were living in Berlin today, it's dark, wet, miserable. Do you think the traffic lights just stop working in Berlin because it's raining? What's so special about our traffic lights in Johannesburg? Can we find some way to just say, I mean, I know we're unique, you know, we're the only country in the world that calls traffic lights robots. So, you know, they are unique, but what's going on here?
Do they like turn off, or do they do that thing where they flash red? Because I always wonder, like, if you, Mr. Traffic Light, can flash red, if you've got it in you to flash red, surely you could do the other colors as well. Well, how come the red flashing thing works?
I don't know. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Talk politics.
Let's do that justice. Let's be gone, or rather begin, because who wants to be gone?
Let's be gone. Let's begin. It's December, boss. Let's be gone.
Let's begin with this Eskom inquiry that's meant to be unfolding, where a whole lot of people are meant to give testimony and share accounts so that we can all get to the bottom of some or other kind of resolution. Mm. Except, what isn't happening at the Eskom inquiry?
What isn't happening? There's so much happening and there's so much that's not happening. You remember a few weeks ago we spoke about Suzanne Daniels, who is the chief lawyer at Eskom. She's the head of compliance at Eskom, the legal head. Suzanne Daniels arrived and said, oh, you know, I was invited to have tea with Mr. Essa, who is very influential and is very close to the Gupta family. She went to Melrose Arch, arrived there, they had a coffee, and he said, no, I'm taking you to a meeting. They got in and left, went upstairs to one of those fancy apartments, and there was the deputy minister of public enterprises, Mr. Dikobe, Ben Martins. There was one of the Gupta brothers, and there were a whole bunch of other people. So she went, and under oath, as I always like to say, she is a lawyer. She understands that when you say under oath, it means that you can actually be charged for perjury if you are lying. So under oath, she says, this is what happened. This was the meeting. She even described what the Gupta brother was wearing. He was in his flip-flops and tracksuit pants.
How very casual.
How very casual. This was a meeting with, you know, the Eskom's lawyer. And in that meeting, he asked about what's happening with Brian Molefe's case. Can you push it to after the December ANC conference? And so she said she left that meeting, called her people at Eskom and said, make sure that that case happens before the December conference. Why does he want it be after the that conference? So Ben Martins jumped up and down and said, no, how dare you implicate me in this? I wasn't there, and so forth. The Gupta brother said, I wasn't there. He sent through a snapshot of a YouTube video in which he says, look, I was at a religious ceremony in India somewhere.
Oh.
And so forth and so forth. But they don't want to come to the inquiry and be asked any questions. Why don't they want to be asked any questions? The day before, so it's Thursday, so on Tuesday, we saw Anoush Singh, who is the man who was the chief financial officer at Eskom, the man who paid all these monies to companies like Tegeta, millions, billions of rand. Suddenly, he was asked in July to come and appear. On Monday evening at 11 p.m., he sends the committee 400 pages and said, read this before you ask me any questions. All these people are fast asleep, getting their beauty sleep, okay, just so that they can be ready for him at 9 a.m. on Tuesday. This is what he does. So yesterday, for me, the main thing was that as proceedings were unfolding and there was toing and froing, the chair of the committee, Zuki Swaranto, says, you know, I can't focus on what we're doing today because a member of the Hawks has just come up to me and said, give me your details.
For what good reason?
Exactly. Because let's think about it. The Gupta mails have been in the public domain for now 10 months. 9 months. We know all this stuff. The Hawks have been begged by absolutely everyone except Jacob Zuma to investigate what's gone on with the Guptas and all this stuff. And they haven't done anything. Parliament and this committee decides we're going to do this thing, okay, no matter what. We're going to find out what really happened. And suddenly, instead of... So... It's like the scene of the crime, right? So someone's been killed here, we ask some of the guys to come and investigate what's happened here and so forth. The police don't come. No, there's no crime. There's no basis to investigate. Only when other people are looking into it, they come and say, why are you looking into that? Instead of saying, what's happened here? Someone's been killed. We've got to find the killer and so forth and so forth. So this is what, for me, I think South Africans, we need to connect some dots here. First of all, Anoush Singh, who enabled, who was key to the state capture project, basically dodges the state capture inquiry, the ESCOM inquiry in Parliament, by sending them all these documents the night before and making sure, by the way, they said to him, get out, you are insolent, you're this and so forth, get out of our committee, come back in January. But he achieved something. He's not going to be asked about it until January. The Guptas send two lawyers, and those lawyers say, we will only come here if you tell us, if you send us all your questions beforehand, all this. Ben Martins, who said, oh, Suzanne Daniels is a liar, says, no, I'll just send you a statement. I won't come and answer questions. All these people are trying for one thing. They're trying to make sure that they get to that committee in January or February or whenever, after the ANC conference. So my question is, what do they know about the ANC conference starting on December 16 that we don't know?
Yeah.
Are they hoping that someone will win and that person will say, why do we have this inquiry? Stop it now. What's happening in Parliament with this inquiry and what's happening outside with the ANC conference begins to make me wonder whether actually we're having a free, fair ANC conference in Nasrec next weekend, or we're having someone playing, pulling the strings about who wins and so forth. All of them were trying to make sure that nothing happens. You connect the dots from what Suzanne Daniels said when the Gupta brothers said, I can't remember which one, Tony or Atulu or one of them, but said, make sure that Brian Molefe's hearing only happens after December. What is going to happen at the ANC conference, and what do they know?
It sounds to me like we're dealing with a network of people who, for whom it's not in their best interest for them to just hope on a result. They need a guaranteed result
yeah.
to work in their favor. So therefore, makes some sense. Meddling would need to happen if you want to guarantee a particular result.
Exactly. And so they know what that kind of meddling is. Before we move on from that ESCOM inquiry, one of the things that I found, amazing and interesting was that Zuki Soranto gets asked by the Hawks guy, you know, give me your details. But by the way, the Hawks guy then says, oh, sorry, we were just in parliament on another matter. So we thought we'd pop in and get and help the committee with its investigation. Now, you know, this country, guys, we need to, if let's take the example of the someone being murdered in the studio, which won't happen. It's a criminal matter. The police, the Hawks, have to come here and say someone's been killed and open a criminal case, and someone will go to court, and someone will go to jail. So the Hawks have to open a criminal case against the people who defrauded and stole at Eskom. Mm-hmm. Why haven't they done it? And then why are they going to the parliamentary inquiry? It's the same thing as Jacob Zuma saying, yeah, I want a judicial commission of inquiry into state capture. In fact, we must stop. I'm calling on all South Africans. We must stop all judicial commissions. Even this parliamentary inquiry must stop. We need people to be investigated criminally and to appear in court and to go to jail.
Yeah.
So if you say, for example, with the Steinhoff thing all over the place this morning, people losing billions of rand, civil servants losing billions of rand from their pensions and so forth. If Marcus Joster, who was the CEO of Steinhoff, actually did fiddle the books and the Germans, you know, God bless their souls, if they find that he did fiddle the books and so forth and so forth, you know what? In Germany, they won't have a commission of inquiry. They're going to say, we have a criminal matter. This man fiddled with the books, misstated a billion rands, and he will appear in the commercial crimes court, and he will go to jail. Everyone wants, commission of inquiry, parliamentary. No one goes to jail. No, I'm sorry. Someone needs to go to jail. Anyway, on Zuki Soranto, this Hawks guy goes to her and says, give me your details and so forth and so forth. Out of the blue like that. Now, for me, what's scary is that it happens as the Gupta matter comes to a head in parliament. But secondly, that her son, a few months ago, was threatened. Someone went to her son and said, your mother's being obstinate. Why is she asking all these questions in parliament and so forth? So this is the second time that she's being intimidated. And why is it happening when the Guptas are supposed to appear, when the key piece of evidence is supposed to happen? And I think the Hawks need to account whether they are being used by the Gupta family, like so many other arms of our state, the NPA in particular, which is refusing to prosecute, or not. And I haven't heard a single thing that says they're not. Why did they appear yesterday out of the blue on the day that the Guptas, that Ben Martins, all the people around the Guptas were supposed to appear? I think it's very, very suspicious, and we should all be a little bit worried about these things.
All right. Well, Justice, come next weekend, a lot of us, and I speak for myself, are going to be either drinking too much or eating too much because, you know, for a lot of offices will be shutting down next weekend. There's that whole day of reconciliation vibe. Like, people are just looking to chill. However, it's going to be going down at the ANC NEC elective conference.
Yeah.
So what is the current state of affairs between Cyril Ramaphosa and NDZ, who essentially are the two contenders? Either or, like, one of them will be the next president of the ANC?
Yeah. Mabale, you know, listeners of this show, podcast, will remember, I mean, we've been banging on about this. It's a bit like, do you know that Marcus Joster has 450 race horses? So it's a bit like being...
Oh, what?
I know. I find it amazing.
What a splendid group.
450.
He doesn't. He's lost count.
So one of the things that I find amazing... So we've been trying to get a handle on this for the past 2 years. And Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma was always ahead because KwaZulu-Natal, Mpumalanga and so forth, the Premier League, and we've spoken about them again and again, were solidly behind her to win this thing. It's now got to a point where the branches of the ANC have declared themselves. At the moment, it's about 1,800 branches for Cyril Ramaphosa, 1,300 branches for Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. So on the face of it, one would say Cyril Ramaphosa is ahead. And so a lot of people, and a lot of people in business, and a lot of people who listen to this show would say, oh, well, it's nearly there. It's nearly all done and dusted. But if you go to, and we've spoken about Durban, Etegwini rather, about the branches there, some of those branches, instead of sending one delegate, they'll send four or five delegates. So when you say Cyril Ramaphosa is ahead, you're counting the number of branches, but there's about 1,000 extra people coming to that conference, and those people, we don't know how they'll vote, and that could swing it for Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. Both sides are spewing out numbers. Everyone has become a statistician. Everyone is counting to the very last minute. And it's neck and neck. The key decider now, Zizi Kotwa, I find it amazing that we now accept that bribery is part of the political language in South Africa. So there are allegations, for example, in the Northwest, which have been aired publicly on television and so forth, that people are being offered cash to vote in certain ways. The ANC Zizi Kotwa is on the record as saying, if someone offers you money, if someone tells you to do this or that, excuse me, take the money, but vote as your branch has told you to vote. Don't. So essentially, he's given up that, okay, it's happening, and there's bags of cash being thrown around. So, you know, I mean, next Friday, you might be having a lovely meal and a few glasses of wine, but around Nasrec, maybe not around Nasrec, at all the places where delegates will be staying and sleeping and so forth, there will be a lot of cash passing around. And to the point we were making earlier about what's happening, why do people want things to happen after this conference? I think there'll be a lot of people trying to buy votes to make sure that they get a preferred outcome. So it's not just who's going to vote for who and who's winning on the merits. It's also who will be bribed, who will be bought, who can bribe more, and what impact that will have on democracy within the ANC. It's a scary thought that we have in this conversation, but that's where it is now. Cyril Ramaphosa is ahead in terms of branch nominations, but Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma has a lot of delegates who are uncounted who will be there. One could say it's exactly the same thing with Cyril's uncounted numbers, and that's fair enough. So if you were to ask me to call it right now, I have a huge problem. I don't actually know. I think that Cyril Ramaphosa has done a lot, but what was the American expression? The known unknowns and the unknown unknowns are so many that I'm finding it difficult to call it. If you pressed me, I would say one of the biggest mistakes we've made in analysis in South Africa is to think that because we like someone, then we believe their story when they say they are winning. One of the abiding memories I have was of Polokwane in 2007 when Thabo Mbeki was up against Jacob Zuma. Now, Thabo Mbeki, I mean, is a serious guy. You know, he's got an MA in economics. Mm. He speaks so well.
Yes.
He smokes a pipe. Mm.
I'm an African speech,
I'm an African, you know, I mean, he arrives at the United Nations, everyone, you know, from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to whoever, it's like, okay, now we're going to get something, yes. You know, and when he leaves, it's like, ooh, the intellectual drought has been removed. He's so, you know, and then he has a glass of like amazing single malt whiskey.
What a man.
You know, the cut of his clothes, everything's fantastic. Huh? Mm. So people were, Thabo Mbeki was seductive, intellectually seductive, even with HIV AIDS and his denialism, his horrible Zimbabwe policy, which aided and abetted Mugabe, he was still intellectually very, very attractive, very curious. You might not have liked Thabo Mbeki, but you wanted to listen to him because something new came out of there, something deep and, curious. He had a curious mind. He wanted, you know, I mean, I'll speak for myself. When he started speaking about Haiti and what the Haitian Revolution was, this was the first black republic. It was like, guy, when do you get time to find these things? And just drinking from these guys. So one of the things that happened in 2007 is that people walked around believing that, oh, he's going to win because he's like us. We love him. He's beautiful, he's got a beautiful mind and so forth. So in Polokwane, Jacob Zuma won by 60%, Thabo Mbeki got 60% of the votes. And people were absolutely, totally devastated. They were weeping. I mean, I actually saw people crying because they hadn't analyzed, they had put their hearts into, oh, you know, Thabo is so good, he's so... You know, he's so...
Were you one of the people crying, Justice?
Sorry?
Were you one of the people crying?
No, I wasn't, actually, because I'm not saying this. I mean, you can go and look at my writing at the time. I actually read it right because I tried not to... Like so many people who are like me, and all of us very curious about Thabo Mbeki and very attracted by him because of this. And knowing what, because, you know, let's not make mistakes about this. We all knew what Jacob Zuma was like. He was going through a rape trial. He had those 783 charges of corruption, counts of corruption, fraud, racketeering against him. His business associate, Shabir Sheikh, was already in jail. We knew Jacob Zuma was not an unknown quantity. So I knew exactly what Jacob Zuma was. I wasn't one of the people crying because I had read the mood in the ANC, and it was, even with Thabo Mbeki being this, in the greater community, being this attractive quantity inside the ANC, people had had enough of him and people wanted him to go. Part of the problem was that Thabo Mbeki had been very successful. The economy had grown. Many people had become rich. Many people had become middle class, prosperous, but they wanted more, and they thought with Jacob Zuma perhaps that would happen. Inside the ANC, Thabo Mbeki was very controlling, and so I knew that Thabo was going to lose, but people wouldn't believe that. So I wasn't crying because I'd read it up front. And one of the mistakes about this race for next week is that a lot of people are saying, oh, Cyril, he is so lovely. He's made so much money. He owns McDonald's.
He's a lawyer. Because that's a great qualifier.
He's a lawyer. He speaks so well.
He said it's a great mistake, right?
It's a great mistake to think that because I like you, then it means you're going to win.
Yeah.
It just means
I was one of those people. Yeah.
So I like you, but I have to be absolutely cold about the numbers and the facts in front of me.
Like ability doesn't sign off on things and make change.
Exactly. So I worry when so many people are already saying, oh, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa's won it because he is largely the middle class choice. He's largely the educated class choice and so forth. Even though, you know, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is a doctor and so forth, but the people around her disqualify her from being, in many ways, that preferred choice that she was actually in 2007 when she was by Thabo Mbeki's side against Jacob Zuma. So she sort of jumped to the other side, as it were. So, you know, if you forced me right now to say who's going to win, I actually think that the ruthlessness of Jacob Zuma, the brutality of Jacob Zuma being behind the Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma campaign has the ability to force the 233 delegates who wrote unity on their ballots from Mpumalanga to go in with her, and for the rest to be manipulated in some way, and for some to genuinely vote for Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. I would say maybe by 10, 15 votes, but, you know, that raises another specter.
That's very, very close.
We might be having Turkey at Nazrek on the 25th as people fight over, no, we need a recount, we need a recount, we need a recount, and so forth. So it's so close to call, I'm having doubts, but I can't write off Jacob Zuma, and I can't write off the campaign that he's backing, because Jacob Zuma has been winning since 2005. We might have criticized him, said all sorts of things. Here we are, 12 years later, Jacob Zuma is still president of South Africa. Jacob Zuma has fired Pravin Gordhan, has fired Thabo Mbeki, has fired everyone. He's still winning. And a winning streak that has lasted 12 years, I'm scared to call it right now. Jacob Zuma wants Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, and that's late to win. And I tell you now, there was a time when I underestimated Jacob Zuma. I don't anymore.
No, underestimate him at your peril. Yeah. Okay, so Justice, not everybody is going to be able to keep the filth that they've swept under their rug hidden for long, as we are finding with Naspers and Steinhoff, where all sorts of allegations of unethical misconduct are now being leveled.
But I think, part, you know, to that point, your crime scene analogy comes to mind. It doesn't have to be swept under the rug anymore. You can go, there's my rug, there's the filth, there's my broom. So on we carry. So what were we talking about again?
No, absolutely. But I think one of the things that we face, there's two kinds of crimes that one has to look at here. So one of the key things about the multi-choice story is that ANN7, which is owned by the Guptas, which was owned by the Guptas, they say they've sold it to Mzwanele, Jimmy Manye.
Yes.
They say. We'll see. But one of the things that happened is that in 2013, Imtiaz Patel, who was the CEO of MultiChoice South Africa at the time, said that MultiChoice did not pay any money to so there's a carriage fee that you own the TV station, they pay you money to give them that station and be on their on the MultiChoice DSTV bouquet. He said, we don't pay these guys any money. But it turns out that they had paid 25 million rand up front and another 141 million rand, and all in all it's 250 million rand over time, over 5 years, I believe, paid to the Guptas. Now, the key thing is not actually, that's kind of normal in these kinds of arrangements, and the monies are mind-boggling, the amounts are mind-boggling, but the key thing was that at the time, MultiChoice DSTV was was lobbying government and the Minister of Communications at the time, Faith Mutambi, to choose between encryption and non-encryption of digital content and so forth and so forth. And the allegation that's come out from the DA and from the papers that they have is that actually when she agreed to go the way they wanted her to go, that's when that first tranche of money was paid. And the suspicion that that money made its way to her. That is where the multi-choice story becomes problematic. And that is where multi-choice and in particular Koos Bekker, who's the main player in Naspers, have failed to come out very clearly and say, this is what happened and this is how it's going. The executives have not been touched, so we don't know. They're just denying. And in their denial, they sound like bad politicians denying state capture. And what it does for, in my view, for people like Bonang Mohale and others, BLSA, who've been saying, we as business don't want to see this and so forth, is that, you know, the next time those guys go to a meeting with government and say, you guys must stop corruption, they're going to say, ah, but what about multi-choice? And why is multi-choice investigating itself, not saying we will bring in an outside counsel, outside KPMG or something like that to come and investigate? Why are you saying, oh, multi-choice will do it ourselves and we'll believe you? Really? It's a big problem. With the Steinhoff thing and Mr. Marcus Joster and his 450
racehorses. Wow.
I know.
Must be nice.
What do you do with 450 racehorses?
You count them, Justice. You count them.
You find out which one is the fastest.
Okay, now. Boys and girls.
But you can do that with 50.
Yeah, 450. What's going on with this guy? Does he have like a fetish or something? Just weird stuff.
Maybe you sell them, like, I don't know, man. They breed them? I don't know. Like,
Yeah. I think he breeds himself. But, man, it's just... It's a lot of horses. Anyway, so... with that, I mean, you know, my view is that there will be... It's absolutely what you say. You know, this stuff will come out, and people will go to jail, and that's okay. And I hope someone actually goes to jail so that we can start to believe... Well, actually, now that I've said it, maybe we need to stop here. Think about SAP, the company that was implicated in the Gupta leaks here. It's a big German company. SAP is being investigated in Germany, but SAP paid people money, or people close to the Guptas. They paid them money in South Africa. 109 million rand to get one contract, yeah? So they pay CIA 109 million rand. And then when the investigation starts, the first thing that SAP does is rush to New York and say to the New York Stock Exchange, ooh, we think we bribed someone. You know why they did it? Because in America, if you bribe someone, if you're listed on the stock exchange in the U.S., a stock exchange in the U.S., and you bribe someone in Ghana or South Africa or Uzbekistan, there's something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And it says any American company that is corrupt anywhere in the world, we're coming for you. We don't come for you just here in America. We come for you anywhere. And you might be German, but if you're listed in America and you are corrupt in Uzbekistan, we're coming for you. Mm. So SAP rushes to the U.S. and says, we think we paid a bribe, sorry. But they don't do it in South Africa. Because they know that, in South Africa, nothing's going to happen there.
Yeah.
So these guys have already admitted what they've done in the U.S., but in South Africa, nothing. So no one's going to go to jail. They paid a bribe of 109 million rand to a Gupta-linked company, and it's all okay. Mm. It's all fine. So I'm telling you now, the Steinhoff matter will be, something will happen in Germany. Marcus Joster might go down in Germany or might never have traveled to Germany again because they'll be looking for him. But here in South Africa, I haven't seen the hawks who are busy with people in parliament, I haven't seen them jumping up and down and saying, Baba, we're going to go and go after some people in...
Aren't they too busy with Jacques Po and company?
Yes. Oh, right. Oh yes. Let's go arrest some journalists.
Yeah, don't be unkind. The hawks are busy, man. It's hard for the hawks.
Yes, yes. I think they might arrest, Pravin Gordhan. Oh, or maybe Mkhebisi Jonas. Why did he reveal that he was offered a bribe? Dirty, dirty man.
All right, I think that is where we will leave it with the burning platform with Justice Malala. Thank you for joining us, as always.
Thank you, guys.
We have come to that tricky time of the year where we decide, is this your last Thursday with us or not?
Because no. Next Thursday is our last.
Oh, okay. All right.
Oh,
so you are back next week.
Yeah, we're back next
week. No, you have to be back next week because it will be after. Oh, it will be before.
It will be the day before. Every, you know, there'll be buses coming in from the Eastern Cape.
Will you be going to Nazareth?
I'm going to Nazareth.
Front row seat. You can't miss
it. No, I can't miss it. Look, guys, I mean,
are you basically a VIP there at No, I think you must be, Justice. I think you are.
I've been going to ANC conferences since 94, but I never get VIP. I'm more like, what does he want here? Who's that guy? Stop that guy. But I'm telling you guys, this one is historic, and I don't know if you guys are making your way there, but
I'd love to actually.
The ANC conference this year might be the last one where you see a united ANC. It is possible that you know, in 2009 we had a splinter with COPE and a significant one. 7% of ANC voters basically left the ANC and went and voted for COPE in 2009. 2013 we saw EFF, but I think if things get really bad and people say this has been stolen, if there is the kind of bribery and stuff that people are talking about, this may be the last united ANC conference that we see. So after 106 years, after an organization started by an amazing human being, Pixley Gaisakaseme. He was 32 years old, Sia, so you still have a chance. Pixley Gaisakaseme was 32 years old when he came back from Oxford University and got every chief, every teacher, every lawyer, every journalist, and got them to Bloemfontein Mangaung in 1912 and formed the ANC with John Dube as the first president. And I think this conference may be the last of that great ANC that we see. So history is being made, guys. You better get in there before, you know, you say, oh, I didn't go. Justice was there. But I'm going. It's going to be fun.
Wow. I am ready for next week. That's basically it. Yeah. Mr. Malala, thank you very much for stopping by.
Absolute pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.